Yes. Yes, good morning. Who is not cozy, student?
I think she is not here who asked that question.
Okay, but she is cozy, student?
No, she's not.
Oh, she's not. Yeah. And now she's not here. What do we do with such students then? Okay. So it's only cozy now in this room. So where are all the students?
I think this crash course is for cozy students.
I think this is just a normal lecture now. Okay. Good. Now, I mean, for most other students, this course is considered as an elective. So then perhaps in the very beginning, you know, most of the students, they serve different courses. And then I think it's middle of September. Then they have to sign up formally for the course to be able to take the exam. So it could be that they figure out that this is not of their interest or, yeah. Yes. No, because first of all, I wanted to tell to one of these students, which I don't remember the name. She asked me about the pupil, not the size, but the shape. And then, I just asked Google Scholar, and then I found this very interesting. Comprehensive paper, so which I uploaded. So, but maybe if she comes later or another day, then. But what is this now? Hello. Okay. Yes. Otherwise, I still need one or two volunteers in the reference group. There was one student. Yes, I don't remember who is the. Yeah, okay, very good. Sorry, very happy for that. Could you please just send me an email? Is somebody else interested, highly interested, then. We will be four in the group. It's not necessary. Okay. Then just send me an email, and then we will have two meetings during the semester. Okay. Then we go back to the crash course. I'm also aware of, in terms of color science and colorimetry, that you have had a lecture with Professor Phil Green yesterday addressing uniform color spaces, CIE, and so on. And I was discussing with him whether I should kind of recap his lecture from yesterday with my slides. I don't know exactly what he has addressed, so there might be some overlap or perhaps some redundancy, which probably is not that bad to hear things over again with a different voice. And then secondly, I thought there are some other students showing up today which are not part of his course. And the course cross-media color reproduction. So, yes. So last time we talked in general about the way of describing colors in terms of color mixing, using certain primaries and the intermixture of these primaries. And then we talked about, related to that, what is additive color mixing, what is subtractive color mixing related to typically devices. Then we also addressed perceptible color system. Perhaps you remember this famous Munsell tree, where Munsell has used the three attributes: value, also black and white, chroma, and hue, to describe the colors. And the beauty with such a system is that all these color patches have the same perceptible distance, whether you go towards chroma or lightness or hue. And then lastly, we addressed very briefly color matching, which is the foundation for the CIE color system and CIE XYZ and CIE LAB. I don't know why this is switching over. Oh, okay. Okay, now I know. Power, yes. Okay. Good. And perhaps we can make front, okay, rear a little bit like that. So then we have a little bit more contrast, and you know, in vision, it's all about contrast. So, okay, then let's start this off. Okay. Yes, so today I will talk mainly about the CIE system and focus on the standard ops server, also going back a little bit in history to Guild and Wright, the two scientists, which then leads me to uniform color spaces as well, and finally to color differences. So I added a kind of an important link to the color and vision research laboratory, where you can find a database providing a comprehensive library of downloadable standards and data sets relevant to color and vision research. Then to start, the CIE system, although there are some other color specification systems, but by far the most important of all the color specification systems is the development of the CIE. The CIE, the International Color, not the International Color Consortium, that's color management, but the Commission Internationale de l'Éclairage, or International Committee on Illumination. The system provides standard methods for specifying a color stimulus under certain controlled viewing condition. And the system is originated in 1931 and was further developed in 1964. And these are the known CIE 1931 and CIE 1964 supplementary system. So the system standardizes the three key component or elements of perception. And this is a light source, the standard observer, and an object. So the X, Y, Z color space is based on the three quantities or stimuli. So first of all, the three stimuli values X, Y, Z for a given object can be calculated, also based on the illumination under which the object is illuminated and the reflectance properties of the object, and then finally the color matching function, and we are ending up with the three values called x, x, y, z. So as I mentioned, in 1931, that's a kind of very important date in color science, a group of color scientists were asked to match a test light consisting only of one wavelength by adjusting the energy level of three separate primary lights, so in terms of red, green, and blue. Under very controlled conditions, the three primary lights were then additively mixed to obtain a match with the test color. And the amounts of the primaries used for any given stimulus are known as these three stimulus values. So the ultimate aim of the color matching experiment was to generate the data necessary for constructing a formal, quantitative, rigorous system for characterizing color, also the CIE standard observer and the CIE color space. And this sketch shows the experiment setup for additive color mixing using three primary colors to adjust to match the test color. So basically, that is the observer, that is a kind of a black box. Then we have a test illuminant, so to produce a monochromatic light. Monochromatic means perhaps one or a very narrow band area of light, perhaps one nanometer. And then we are using three primary colors, red, green, and blue, and the goal is then to obtain a match with the test lamp, also adjusting the luminance of red, green, and blue, and that across the visible spectrum. So that is the mirror, the white screen, illuminating from the test color, and then on that side you have the illumination of the three primary colors, and that is just the sketch seen from the observer with the test color of the biparty field. And then the lower side is the match of the three primary colors. You might find a sketch on the internet, which is indicating here. So you can choose a test color, 580 nanometers, for instance. And then you can play with the three primary colors to obtain a color match. You have basically the slider where you increase or decrease the primary colors, and then basically by a match you end up at 580 nanometers with a certain amount of blue, a certain amount of green, and a certain amount of red, which you obtain a color match. And that basically you do across the entire visible spectrum, or that has been done back in 1928 and 1931. So the color matching does not attempt to describe how colors appear to human. Color matching tells us how to numerically specify a measured color and then later accurately reproduce that measured color, such as in any kind of media, so print or display and so on. So to reiterate that point, color matching systems are not focused on describing color with qualities like hue or saturation. They just tell us what combination of light appears to be the same color to most of us. So color matching basically allows us to build a framework for color reproduction. So historically, the most important experiments for determining the trichromatic response of the eye were carried out by these two scientists, David or William David Wright in 1928 and John Guild. So in the Wright experiment at the Imperial College in London, 10 observers carried out the matching experiment using three primary colors at 360, 530, and 650 nanometers. Then 3 years later, in the Guild experiment at the National Physical Laboratory, 7 observers used three primary colors at 460, 543, and 630 nanometers. And then in 1931, the CIE transformed the two sets of the color matching functions into a single set of color matching functions and found a good agreement between the two data sets. So it's quite amazing that still nowadays all color science and colorimetry is based on the experiment and on a data set obtained by 17 observers representing the entire world population. Of course, now you can ask the question, is that statistical kind of true? But, I mean, it's not only in color science, you know, that these early kind of establishment took place. It's in many other fields as well, where the big breaking through happened 200 years ago or 100 years ago. But it doesn't mean that it is not possible to improve such systems. And as I mentioned previously, we are building a kind of a similar system with different type of light sources and different measurement technologies. And we try to kind of rebuild the system. It will take some time, and there's a lot of politics involved, as I mentioned. But because later on we will see that the aim is always to get a kind of a uniform color space, but still we have not reached the goal. There has been many attempts, but still in certain area of the color spaces, the uniformity is not as good as expected. And then you add just corrections and another correction and another correction on a kind of a starting data, which can be questioned. So instead of adding a lot of functions to a kind of reduce the error, the question is why not starting from scratch? So to obtain trichromatic matches, various parts of the experimental setup must be precisely specified. And because the retina varies considerably in its properties, as we have seen from one part to another, it is necessary to specify also the angular size of the matching field, meaning that should the patch be very small so that we expose only the fovea, where we know we have mainly L and M cones, just slightly a few S cones as well, or should the size be bigger so that we expose a bigger part of the retina, because then we will have different judgments. So standards exist nowadays for two fields, 10 degrees and 10 degrees. The original system was based on two field size. Then the precise color of red, green and blue matching stimuli need to be specified, also the nanometer of the monochromatic light, and of course also the luminance. So one thing is to have a light at 700 nanometer and for the red, and one can be on the blue with 435.8 nanometer, but the luminance is not identical. So to be able to define a standard observer, the spectral composition and the luminance of the primaries need to be specified. And to combine the two sets, also from Guild and Wright, each set of the data were then transformed mathematically to what would have been obtained if the following monochromatic matching stimuli had been used, meaning these primaries with these certain nanometers of monochromatic light. The green and blue stimuli were chosen to match the two prominent lines in the mercury discharge spectrum from Guild. So the red stimuli was chosen to be part of the spectrum where hue changes very slowly with the wavelengths, so that to reduce the effect of any errors in the calibration. So the results were also transformed to what would have been obtained, as I mentioned, if the amounts red, green, and blue would have been measured using not units of luminance, but units of that result in the whitening matched by equal amount of the primaries. So the requirement was then that for an equi-energy spectrum, also a spectrum where you have the same power across the visible spectrum, the addition of the unit amounts of the three primaries should give a color match. So for instance, if one candela per square meter of red was used, one candela square meter, then the green should be at 4.5, also much higher, but then the blue much less. So the ratio for the luminance to obtain equi-energy spectrum is then based on one unit red, 4.5 unit green, and just a tiny unit of blue to obtain an equi-energy spectrum. Do you follow? Okay, so then the curves in that figure are known as the CIE-1931 RGB color matching function. And they are available in the CIE publication 15.2 colorimetry, and I think it's the fourth edition out now. I think you're also able to download a PDF version. So if you Google CIE publication 15.2, you will find at least the first, second, and the third edition. So the color matching functions, they show the amount of primaries needed to match the color of the spectrum, as I showed previously in the previous slide. So these are the 700 nanometer monochromatic red light, the green light, and the blue light. And the lines, they indicate the amount of primary color needed at a certain nanometer in the visible spectrum to match that monochromatic light. So then that is the same information in a table form. So if you have a look at the CIE 15.2 document, then you will find the color matching functions. So these are the R bar lambda, G bar lambda, B bar lambda. Bar, by the way, means average. So it's average because it is based on the 17 observers. And then you have the corresponding chromaticity coordinates, R lambda, G lambda, and B lambda, which I will get back in a couple of minutes. Yeah, and some years ago at the Color Imaging Institute in Derby, and they had such a color tutor where we students also could obtain our own color matching function. It was just based on 10 or 12 monochromatic light across the visible spectrum. Do you notice something special in that graph?
Negative values.
What is the reason for these negative values? Any idea?
Well, because that light could not be reproduced without adding red to the light we want to be as a reference.
Mm. Right. So probably in that area, the test light is too saturated, and then it is not possible to get a proper saturated color match by using green and blue. And to desaturate, we add the primary color to the test color, basically. But then we are ending up with some minus value, yes. So it has certain negative values. And the implication of that it was not possible to match these wavelengths using all positive amounts. So then basically, if that is the test color, we need to add some of the primary colors to be able to match green and blue, and then basically we just put the plus red on the other side of the equation, and then it's minus red plus green and blue. So that is basically what it is about. Color matching experiments showing the color to be matched, for instance, at 500 nanometers. No combination of red, green, and blue we have chosen can be added to make a match. So then we need to change the setup, and we need to add the red to the test site to be able to get a color match. So in 1930, the manually calculation of negative and positive values were kind of complicated. I mean, today nobody might think about, but there was no fast computer or computer at all. And also it prone to error. So therefore CIE introduced a linear transformation that would allow the use of three imaginary primaries that are referred as the X, Y, and Z. So linear combinations is a way of rescaling the numbers to make the graph behave in a more convenient fashion. So then as a consequence, all X, Y, Z stimulus values are then positive. But that is the transformation matrix. So these 3x3 matrix has been applied to get rid of the negative values, and at the same time the Y combination is corresponding to the V lambda function and the respective luminance. So N here is the normalization constant. So there is an N as a constant, and N is equal to the V lambda function. And the V lambda function is basically the ratio of the luminance of red, green, and blue divided by the same ratio. So the ratio of this and the ratio of this is similar. So then we are ending up with the total luminance, adding red, green, and blue, of 5.6. So that is the n as a constant. So that I just added another publication from 1996. So if you want to go into the details to find out how these coefficients, certain coefficients, has been obtained. So we are ending up with the color matching function of the CIE 1931 XYZ color specification system. And we do have the following properties. So firstly, the Y bar lambda function is identical to the V lambda function. Okay, let's see if I go back. No, how do I go back? Okay. So this Y bar lambda is identical to V lambda. The values X bar, Y bar, Z bar, lambda are all positive for all wavelengths in the spectrum. And the equi-energy spectrum is specified by equal amount of X, Y, and Z. And then we are ending up with this XYZ color matching function 1931. Coming back to the viewing field observer angle, so only with the definition of the viewing conditions, which includes the observer angle, it was possible to determine the color values of the spectral colors. And as we know, human eye consists of two receptors, rods and cones, and since only cones are used for color perception, the human eye, objective viewing of colors depend on the choosing viewing condition, so that the rods were not addressed. So this graph shows the 2 and the 10 degree viewing conditions. And to create an image on the retina, which is formed under 10 degree viewing condition, is this bird more around the centralized fovea in comparison to 2 degree condition. So if you have a 2 degree, we almost expose only the fovea. Otherwise, with a larger degree, up to 10, more than the fovea is exposed. So at the normal viewing distance of, for instance, 45 centimeters, the circle on the top represents the 2 degrees field on which the 1931 CIE standard observer is based. And then the figure on the bottom is what is called the 10-degree field on which the 1964 CIE standard observer is based on. So then we have the two standard color matching functions combined. So the full line is representing the 1931 standard colorimetric observer, and the dashed line is the 1964 CIE standard observer. So now coming back to cross-media, I assume sooner or later you need to conduct an experiment. So dependent on the project, on the setup, on the stimuli you might choose, then you have to conduct some measurements with the telespectral radiometer, for instance, on the display. So then you obtain radians, and then you need to make the calculation to obtain XYZ θ
three stimulus values. And then you need to know, do I need to obtain or to use 1931 called matching function or 1964? That is also a part of providing understanding about the difference between the two CMFs. Have you talked about that with Professor Phil Green yesterday, I suppose? Okay. Yeah. So from color matching, we are going to take the next step, which is a kind of to move into color space. Another great scientist is the Scottish scientist James Clerk Maxwell, who was famous for his monumental main work unifying the theories of electricity and magnetism. But of the other things he studied was color. And in this image, he's holding a color wheel. Also a mechanical tool he used to investigate combinations of colors. So describe these combinations. He used another mathematical tool called a vector, which is useful in representing quantities that has more than one dimension. So basically, maybe you have used such a disk which has two regions, so you can have a kind of a test region, and then you can have a kind of a target region. So if the disk is spinning, you get a kind of an additive color mixing. So for instance, if half of the disk is red and the other half is green, what kind of color you would obtain by spinning the disk? Yellow, yes, exactly. And then you could have different primaries on the outer disk with different section, and by spinning the disk, then you would obtain basically a color match. So as we mentioned in our color matching experiment, we used three primary colors, which were the three stimulus values. So a color vector is created simply by using these three values to indicate the position at the three-dimensional graph, as shown here in the cube. So the axes are basically green, red, and blue. And as an example, think of red, green, and blue color values where 1.0 equals a fully saturated color. So if you would have a color vector with equal amounts of red and green, but no blue, then the value of 1.0 would be representing the color yellow. And another example would be if you have red, no green and blue, making 1.01, then the resulting color would be magenta. And then finally, if you have same amounts of red, green, and blue, then you obtain white. And in between the space that fills the box are contained with all the colors that can be created by adding red, green, and blue, which is most of the colors we are capable to see. So the box that represents our basic color space has three dimensions. It's nice and a nice concept, but it's very awkward in practice. So it would be much easier to use if we could reduce it down to two dimensions. So we are going to make a plane that goes through one unit at each of the axes. So one unit there, and one unit there. And in, it forms a kind of an equilateral triangle. So that is the triangle we form. So anywhere on this plane, the sum of the three values is one. So anywhere, we obtain one by adding the three vectors. And that is what is called a unit plane. So here we are showing the vector for an intermediate color as it pierces onto the plane. And now, since this is a plane, only two coordinates are basically required to specify the location where it pierces the plane. So then we have reduced the three-dimensional color space into two dimensions. And that is actually also shown in that diagram. So the concept of color minus the intensity is what is called chromaticity. Yeah, only two dimensions. And that is exactly the same sample where we have the red color, green color, and the blue color from the origin. And then we can basically add a unit plane. And all the values end up on that unit plane. So then we can use just two dimensions, minus the luminance that needs to be sacrificed. But this is not a kind of information which got lost. So the two coordinates out of the three are sufficient to locate the color F in the unit plane. And the coordinates R, G, and B are called the chromaticity coordinates. And the diagram showing the chromaticity coordinates is called chromaticity diagram. So the chromaticity coordinates, if I go back, here we go. So these are the chromaticity coordinates, okay? Whereas these are the contribution to the color matching function, the first three rows. Okay, so the red-green chromaticity space is a two-dimensional chromaticity space in which there is no intensity information, basically. So the chromaticity points for all real colors enclosed by the spectral locus and the purple boundary. So that is the purple boundary where approximately 700 nanometers and 400 nanometers are linked together. And that is the spectral locus. Hello? Ah, yeah. Okay, det går bra. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So these colors cannot exist in practice and are therefore called imaginary colors. So if we have a color at R1 and this is R1 from the origin and G1, so that is an imaginary color. But all the colors within the spectral locus are basically the visible colors within the visible range of 380 to 740 nanometers.
By imaginary, you mean that they cannot be perceived by human vision?
It's exactly. It's just mathematically possible. As the x, y, z is also just mathematically. So it's not an illumination, but going back. Very good question. So this system here, with the R, G, and B, these are physical illumination. Okay, so these are a kind of a physical experiment conducted by the 17 observers. But then to avoid the negative values, you can find a linear transformation to get rid of the negative values, and then you obtain the x, y, z color matching function. And then x, y, z are imaginary, mathematically, light sources.
So anything beyond the spectral lattice is imaginary.
Exactly. Okay.
What element did you say the spectral lattice ignores was illuminance?
Luminance. Yes, exactly. On the two-dimension plane.
If you go back, I'm sorry. I see that the wavelengths are on the boundary. So is this like a color?
Sorry, is that a... Yes, exactly.
Not on the axis.
So that indicates the wavelengths. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do we navigate?
Yeah, exactly. So this is approximately 700 nanometers up on the green, 500 nanometers, and then 400 nanometers.
So we go around the boundary, like the spectral locus.
Exactly.
You
mean the axis from the coordinating system? Yes.
Okay, we use that.
We use that later in the chromaticity diagram, in the XY chromaticity diagram. So this is still on the red and green, you know. So this is, it's hardly not used. So then the next step would be then to make a linear transformation to get from there to our chromaticity diagram. And that is then very widely used by using the XY coordinate to determine certain RGB. So if you talk about display RGB, there is multiple type of RGBs. I don't know whether Professor Phil Green has mentioned sRGB or Adobe RGB or Color Match RGB or Cozy RGB, or you can define your own primary colors by choosing a certain coordinate in X and Y indicating a certain blue color or a certain red color or a certain green color. And then you use the coordinates of the system. I need a coffee. Should we have a break, 10 minutes? We continue 12:15? Okay. Good. Any other questions? Or we can take the questions after the break. So do you follow? Is it?
Yes, because we saw it yesterday with Phil. For example, for me, yesterday I was a bit confused, but now it's clearer, so...
Okay, then that's my job. Good. Okay. Yes.
Thank you. kitchen closet in parallel and I have to be there. I can only miss out 2 times. That's why I can't be in the first part of this lecture. Yeah, so I will try to still come for the last block, which is right now. But yeah, that's so unfortunate. Where is it?
Regarding the animal island,
yeah.
I'm so sorry. I have a Norwegian course in parallel, and I have to be there in province.
Okay,
so
okay. No, no
why
problem.
I couldn't come.
But if you just.
But I would be still interested in the answer.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have not read the entire article, but I have uploaded on Blackboard.
Oh, nice.
Where is my? Here we go. Okay, that's it. So I was thinking, when you asked the question, I was a bit, okay, yeah, think. So it has something to do, you know, what kind of animal it is, you know, whether it is a kind of, what do you call this in English? I think it's, whether it is an, I found the word here, an ambush predators, Raubtier. Then it has a certain form, you know, Also, it has something to do, you know, with what is it called? This sharpening. If you take pictures, then you can use a certain aperture, and if the aperture is smaller, then you have a greater field of depth. Yeah, exactly. That means then you can see also more sharp in the close region, you know. And then, of course, it has something to do with night and day. And yeah, so have a look at that.
Yeah, thank
okay.
you so much, Rob.
Yes, good.
About the locus itself. I remember back from, I think that maybe talking about how the locus is created would like clarify some stuff. So for example, I remember that I read somewhere that the locus is made when we take like a uniform spectrum of like equal intensity. Wavelength by wavelength, and we calculate the xy, and it creates this locus for us. Maybe that would like clarify a bit fix that. Yeah, because I think the question that he was asking is more.
Very good. I try with that slide perhaps. So. The CIE, three-stimulus space, can be thought, as I mentioned, as a three-dimensional space with these axes x, y, and z, and the coordinates x, y, z. So there are two different ways of describing the axis. And then the three-stimulus values of a set of color-matching function plots as a kind of a non-usual shape. With the blue lines. So I got this catch after the Burns figure in figure 4.2.4 in the. That is the only online book, but which I kind of recommend this one, okay? So I'm referring to the figure 4.2 there. And then you can. Kind of explore that. So in that figure, you have a unit plane which is added to the three spaces. So the lines beginning at the origin. That is the origin again. Passing through each coordinate, forming the color matching function, and ending at the surface of the unit plane from a horseshoe shape. The green. And then there is a line added between the shortest and longest wavelengths. And then this is rotated, so that is the next task then. So on top, that is a rotation of this, and then a projection is done of the unit plane, looking basically down on the z-axis in the chromaticity diagram, and then we have the small xy chromaticity diagram, and then still indicating 700 nanometer, 550 nanometer to approximately 400 nanometers. It's a kind of more a schematic explanation than a mathematical, which definitely you might find in the Wiszecki style book. Okay, I just need to. Okay, yes, coming back to that slide. Yeah, I was slightly addressing that. The linear transformation, again, between that system to get to the XY. Chromaticity coordinate system. A 3x3 matrix can be applied, and probably you recognize the second row, which is again equal to the luminance. If you calculate, where is this? No, okay. If you calculate, if you multiply this 3x3 matrix with the luminance constant, you end up with the 3x3 matrix, which looks like that. Okay, so then you obtain exactly the same numbers. So it's just a linear transformation to get the transformation from the RG diagram, chromaticity diagram, to the XY, which is again an imaginary diagram. Or vice versa, where you take the inverse of the 3x3 matrix. Okay. That we have seen. Then here I kind of tried to sum up all the notations because there are so many different notations to see or to find. So then this is the real system, also with the real light sources. And then on the bottom, it is the imaginary system. So I don't have to go through that, then you have it there. I don't know whether I have to spend time for that either. So it's the starting off is a color matching experiment. Then you can obtain the CIE LMS. In that case, it's the 2 degrees color matching function. Then, by a linear transformation, you can obtain the RGB color matching function, or the inverse again, or, as we have seen, by a linear transformation, you end up with the XYZ. So it's always just a linear transformation to get from one domain into another domain. Okay. Then another system or standard which the CIE is or has provided is to define a number of standard illuminance for the use in colorimetry of non-luminous reflecting objects. So CIE has defined a number of illuminant A, which is a kind of a typical tungsten light type of source, so where you have a lot of energy in the red region and less in the blue region. But probably one of the most important is the standard illuminant D50 and standard illuminant D65. And D50 typically also in the cross-media color reproduction, talking about ICC, so ICC color management, where D50 is the standard illuminant in the profile connection space, also to convert device colors into non-device colors, or RGB into CIE XYZ, and then back to an output RGB and output CMYK. Then in the current system, it is always considered D50 and 2 degrees observer. Okay? 2 degrees observer, or another word, color matching function 1931. It's the same as 2 degrees, or then you have to specify 10 degrees or 1964. So it's a lot of details which you need to grasp to be precise. It's all about precision and to use the specific type of notations and also writing. Okay, I'll come back to that. Again, these are some of the standardized illuminants. Yeah, I don't have to go into further details to that. Then coming back to the multiplication or to the integration of the three attributes or the three elements. Also, the light source, or we start an object is emulated by the light source, and then we multiply that with the color matching function, with the standard observer representing all people in the world, and then we end up with the three values x, y, z. And that is tried to illustrate. So I got this image from Phil. So basically, Tristimulis values for a given color are calculated by multiplying the object, also the reflectance of that object, times the color matching function, and times the spectral power distribution of the illuminant. Then that's just an example. Then at 600 nanometers, also 0.45 times 0.6 times 995 equals to the Tristimulis value at that certain wavelength. And then you add that up across the visible range. Okay.
That is exactly the same thing, just in a kind of more proper way explained. So to obtain x, y, z between 780 and 380 nanometer, you multiply S, which is the illuminant spectral power distribution, that can be like that, or can be like that, or can be dependent, what you want to integrate, times the surface spectral reflectance of an object, which is a kind of static, the same. So if I measure the spectral properties of that material today, tomorrow, and in a week, or in half a year, it is exactly the same. But the appearance might change dependent on the illumination. Whether I have this light or I have candlelight, then the appearance is different. But the reflectance properties remains the same. That is maybe different if you talk about food. Maybe I told you we had a kind of an experiment once, obtaining spectral reflectance from bacon. And then we know, you know, our meat in general needs to have a certain appearance so that we get hungry to eat. But if the appearance is not as expected, we are not hungry. So then the idea was actually to play with the bacon, also a fresh bacon on a certain illuminant, and it appears wise, it did look good, but the bacon after 1 week or 2 weeks under 20 degrees looks rather different. But then the point was, what kind of spectral power distribution of an illuminant we could apply so that the bacon still looks equal. So then the spectral reflectance has changed on the bacon, but to get proper appearance, then we had to apply another spectral power distribution.
But then that is the XYZ, and then dependent 1 nanometer or 10 nanometer interval. Or okay. And then so we can do the calculation of x, y, z, three stimulus values for material or objects. And then this equation will be used. The only difference now is this k, also the normalizing constant, which is a factor to normalize the three stimulus values according to the lightness of the light source, also setting its y value, capital Y value, 200, and as a result, the y values of the materials are then in the range between 0 and 100, or 0 to 1. So the k factor is basically 100 divided by the light source, and again the y bar lambda, 1 nanometer or 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers. So it's a small constant to add. Yeah, we can also skip that. So I assume you have perhaps already received some Excel spreadsheets, and then probably you have noticed that type of Excel sheet. So basically, this is the range. This is x, y, and z color matching functions, probably 1931 or 2 degrees. Then D50 spectral power distribution. And here, this is an object. So this is just made up. So then basically, then if you click now into that cell, then you have this column X times D50 times the object, ending up with 96. And if you do the same with the Y value, you might end up with 100 at the Y point. And then that is the k factor, which is then calculated using 100 divided by the light source times y. So therefore, it's a very tiny fraction. When it comes to display or light sources, and it looks slightly different. So when calculating three stimulus values for displays, the spectral reflectance factor of the object is not included because there is no object bouncing back photons. So the convention of normalizing the Y value then such that it equals 100 or 1 is generally not used. So instead, photometric values or units are used for which the normalizing constant then in the three stimulus equation is K equals to 683 lumen per watts, known as the maximum luminous efficacy, with Km replacing the k in the previous one. So basically, it is to convert units of watts, also radians, into units of luminance, also photometric domain. That is the reason why this Km, the normalization constant, has been applied. And then again, looking at one of Phil's sheet, it looks exactly the same. So if I look at X, then it is the same column, X times the radians on the display. And then we have the Km value of 683 lumens per watt. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Here?
Do these the dry stimulus values signify?
can I visualize it? You know, like.
Also the X, X, Y, Z.
Yeah, X, Y, Z. Like, what do they signify?
Okay.
So data.
Yeah. I will get there in a minute. Very, very good question. So, an X, Y, Z value basically just gives a very vague indication what kind of color it might be. So, X kind of indicates the amount of reddish, also the long wave area, Y kind of the greenish area, and Z the blue. But we cannot directly correlate X, Y, Z to a certain appearance. So if you have a very high value, a numerical value in X, and a low in Y and Z, that would indicate it's something reddish brown.
And if the Z value is very high and
it's only to a very low, it would indicate it's something is bluish. But otherwise, X, Y, Z is not the kind of, it doesn't give an indication to a certain appearance of a certain stimuli. Then it is required a further calculation.
So then from X, Y, Z, we will go into the chromaticity diagram, or we need to apply to a more uniform color space as the CIE LAB. And then we convert X, Y, Z into a kind of a luminance axis and an opponent, red, green, and yellow, blue. And that makes more sense, or it's much more intuitive to use. But otherwise, X, Y, Z is just three numbers. Very good question. I added also from Burns terms, different terms between the radiometry and the photometry. I don't have to go through that, but please have a look, and if you have some questions, then we can discuss that. Yes, that's just again a schematic repetition recap where we obtain. Oh, back to your question. Where we obtain, firstly, X, Y, Z three stimulus values. And to make these values a kind of visual appropriate for our perception so that we understand, it is this type of color. We have the possibility to convert in the XY chromaticity diagram or in LAB or LCH. So that is now the next step where we are going. So as with the RGB system previously, the chromaticity coordinates Z and Y are established. By the intersection of the color vectors X, Y, and Z. Also, as I mentioned, the plane, we can generate a plane unit, and the plane unit then is based on two dimensions. And to do so this is capital X, Y, Z, so we can then easily calculate the X, Y coordinate, and we know that X and Y and Z is equal to 1, as we have seen in the two-dimensional plane. These stimulus values. And then we end up with this very famous XY chromaticity diagram. And that is the proper way of writing it. Very often, you know, you have different wordings, and you have a dash in between X, Y, and so on. So this is also part of being precise, to use the proper CIE definitions on these color spaces. So we have already seen that the outer curved portion is the spectral locus.
we have the purple line combining long wavelengths with the short wavelengths. So the map of the is quantifying the entire range of gamut or color we are able to see. Now we have the color, so this is a kind of a color image, and I have a couple of slides with color images, but the color is just schematically indicating that on the short, on the long wavelengths, we know it is kind of reddish, 500 is greenish, and here it is bluish. But otherwise, it is spectral, and spectral is no color. So there need to be a process, and then it will be a color back in the brain. So we are just using these colors for pedagogical help. So then my point is, if you write a report, just use a black and white, also no color, just the lines. But if you have a lecture, or if you have a popular science or these type of lectures, then you can use these color slides. Okay, some other properties. It is a very powerful tool. So for instance, what color will result if we mix two different colors? So we have a color there, C1 and C2. And then on that straight line, we have all the intermixtures between that reddish color and that greenish color. Okay? So that is one typical domain. It also tells us that blue and yellow are opponent colors, and if we mix these opponent colors, we end up with white. Remember, LEDs, two components, yellow and blue, and we get white light. or coming back to the definition of the RGB primary coordinates. So, for instance, using the Digital Cinema Initiative, the primaries, which probably all Apple devices are using, then we can read the coordinates for the blue, also based on X 0.15 and Y 0.06, the red and the corresponding green primary. And that is just valid for this type of RGB. So sRGB, or as I mentioned, Adobe RGB or any other RGB, they have a slightly different XY coordinate. So then we can also use that, for instance, for people who have color deficiency. So a person without red is matching every color with their two common primaries, green and blue. So for example, if you pick a color at the range of cyan, then the protanope, also a protanope is a person who lacks the L cones. So the person or a protanope will make a match somewhere on the blue-green axis, not because he or she had red to adjust the mix to a new color, but instead the two colors, they look the same. So all the colors on that line appear the same for a person who is missing. And that is what I basically just said. Avoid this very nice, colorful chart for coursework. And then, very practically, so this diagram, as I just said, is used for typically the parameters, also the calibration parameter of these displays. So an important parameter is the primaries for red, green, and blue, and it is also for the white points. So in that case, we have color match RGB with a gamma of 1.8, white point 5000 Kelvin, and the P22 European broadcast union primaries compared to sRGB, where we have a different gamma and also partially rather different chromaticity coordinates for the primaries. Then the same diagram can also be used to compare different color gamuts. So here I have added color gamut for sRGB, Apple Cinema display, an ISO display, white gamut, this is probably the yellow. And then newspaper, and that is the probably that is the smallest one, that is newspaper, and then green is a kind of coated paper. That is probably that one. So magazine paper and newspaper. So that is just to indicate differences in color gamut. What is dangerous with that type of representation if you talk about differences in the media? What can be dangerous if we use such a representation to indicate differences in different media?
I'm not sure, but the color looks very similar to
each other.
The colors.
You mean these colors? Yeah, okay.
Very difficult to differentiate and confuse between the two yellow colors, white gamut and ISO newspaper.
Sure, yeah. Okay, that's my fault, or that's a design fault. I should have chosen more distinct contrast colors to have the legend accordingly. But beside that, if you just have a look at a newspaper gamut and kind of a magazine gamut, for instance, we see that the newspaper is rather smaller. But what is the danger with that?
You can lose a lot of color information.
Maybe we do not consider luminance.
Yes, exactly. This is just two dimension. Okay.
Is this also not considered saturation?
Yes. Lack of saturation?
Yeah, is that
luminance?
Just
so
maybe I just maybe I have it here. Hold on a second. Hold on a second. Do you have to think? Looking for a distinct image which makes I think I remember now. Now I know. Okay. Okay. Why is it here now? Okay, here we go. Okay, yes. Okay, yes. So, that way we have seen in the previous slide, where we have, this is the color space of a camera or from a scanner on two dimensions. So then to visualize the color gamut of that scanner on a C-Lab space, we get this 3D volume. So if we, yes. So then, for instance, again, if you have a typical, the black and an RGB gamut, and the red is indicating a typical CMYK, that's a paper gamut. Then we can observe there is a difference in the blue region, in the red region, in the blue region, but we can see that in the cyan region, the CMYK color space is expanding compared to the RGB. And if we now have a look at the 3D, so that the black body is indicating the RGB, and the red is indicating the CMYK. So then we can see that in that region, the CMYK has expanded the colors. So the point is, just looking at the 2D, it can be a kind of misleading to make conclusions saying that, yes, definitely I can see one color gamut is smaller or bigger than another, because the luminance information is missing. But very often, especially industry, the dealers or the manufacturers, they use this type of illustration to promote their product. Yeah.
What is the reason for that edge in the display gamuts, like in the blue? I would think that there'd be three edges, but there are four edges. Near the bottom, there's that flat kind of line where you'd expect the third point of the triangle to be. What is it? Where does that come from? In the bottom left corner, you have that.
This bottom, where you expect only three primaries, you mean?
Yeah, I would expect the triangle to have like three points, but it's kind of like a parallelogram with four.
Right. So these are typically ICC profiles. And I think I have used the kind of a freeware tool, and then it is reading out not only the three primary colors, but then you have also a kind of secondary colors. But in a CMYK, you can have these type of color gamut, but then here, it reads out different information from an ICC profile. But just to indicate the pure RGB, then you end up
very good observation, like in this one. So that, coming back, so this is still the chromaticity diagram as it is used to indicate different RGB primary colors. So typically for REC 709, which is the primaries for high dynamic TV, it's very similar to sRGB, and then you have this REC 2020, this huge expanded triangle. Still, to me, this is more a theoretical mathematical color space. I haven't seen so far a display, a high dynamic range display with these huge color gamut. Okay, we have to move on. Problems with the CIE XYZ color space.
As we said, it's hard to include brightness. The perceived color differences is not well correlated with spacing in the color space. That can be proved, or McAdams has proved that in 1942. Well, he showed that the CIE 1931 committee's diagram did not offer a perceptual uniformity. So then he asked observers to make color matches in the different areas of the chromaticity diagram. And then it turned out that the area, for instance, in the blue, so the perceptible difference in the chromaticity diagram in the blue is much, much smaller compared to the green and compared to the red. So XY chromaticity diagram is not perceptible uniform at all. And then there has been multiple attempts to squeeze kind of this chromaticity diagram, also by applying the function to end up with the CIE 1960 color space, with the UV chromaticity space. And you could obtain a slightly improvement. And then further in 1976, the U prime, V prime 1976 chromaticity diagram has been obtained, where the equation further has been extended. And that is now mainly used to represent display colors. So if you have a coursework related to display and display colors, then the U prime, V prime chromaticity diagram will be most appropriate to use, and not the 1931. But still, I made some note. X, Y chromaticity diagram, visual uniformity is 20:1, also very bad. And the U prime, V prime is 4:1. Still not good, but much better due to this kind of distortion. Yes. Then we have to move on to the CLAB. So in 1976, the CIE proposed a three-dimensional CLAB color space, which today it still remains the most popular system for color specification. So again, we have these three dimensions, the lightness axis and the opponent green, red, and yellow, blue. So that I think I have showed that before. So the more advanced computation helps to make the LAB system more perceptibly uniform. So in particular, note how the LAB equation involves functions raised up to power of 1/3. So a cube root function has been applied. And with that, you distort the system to make it perceptive more uniform. So that was the idea, and of course also to have a system with the most relevant attribute of lightness, chroma, and hue, or the opponent color, red, green, or blue, yellow. So then you can calculate the chroma based on the A and B axis, or you can calculate the hue angle, so H star AAB. And you can also then calculate the delta E, which is kind of a very simple Euclidean distance formula. So Euclidean distance is the distance between two points in the three-dimensional color space. Yes. limitation of CLAP. So I don't have to go in details, but one of the major departure is actually in the blue region. So again, so that is the achromatic area, and then you have yellow, blue, red, and green. And a completely or an ideal perceptive color system, you should have a straight line from an achromatic color to a new color. So for instance, on the green, it is not that bad. Also towards 210 degrees. But as soon if it comes to this area, it is far from a straight line. So even though CLAP is considered as a perceptive color space, it is not in certain areas. So that needs to be taken into account, and that needs to be taken into account if you, for instance, deal with what is called gamut mapping. So if we transfer one color space into another color space, so RGB to CMYK or RGB to another RGB color space, then we might have some distortions in that area. Yes. I think we still have 5 minutes to go. Is it okay?
Not really, but okay.
We go. Okay. I try. So this is a kind of to wrap up again. We have an illuminant. We have an object. We have the standard observer. We obtain X, Y, Z. It's difficult to understand what X, Y, Z is, but then we can transfer that to X, Y, and that is the luminance information. Okay, so X, Y, chromaticity plus luminance, and we have all the information we need. Or we can convert that into CLAP, a much better perceptive color system, or we can go from XYZ to RGB or to CMYK. This is cross-media color reproduction, basically. But the next point is from CLAP to color differences. Oh, the heck. Have you talked about metamerism with Phil Green?
No.
Yes? No? A little. Very quickly, we talked about that previously. We have an observer, we have two objects, and we have a light source. These two objects are perceived the same under that illumination. If you replace that illumination with a tungsten light, the same object, then it is a mismatch. Here it looks almost as two physical objects, but we could think of the one object is painted with watercolor red, and that is painted with what is it called, watercolor and other type dispersion,
acrylated
color. Yes, exactly. So these two objects, they have two different reflectance properties. Okay, so if we would look at the spectral distribution, they would look different, but under this illumination, appearance wise it looks the same. And if you go back in the integration lightness times object times color matching function, we always end up with X, Y, Z three values, and that means the chance is, or the likelihood can be quite high that we end up with the same value. That is, if we would have had 6 cones or 15 cones, the likelihood would have been much, much less to obtain the same values. But due to the fact we have only 3 values, chance is higher. So that is basically the idea of metamerism. It is stated basically here in the middle, the human eye contains only three colors, which means that all colors are reduced to three sensory quantities. That is the point. And then we can also represent that mathematically, where we have reflectance, light source, X, Y, Z, color matching function, and then we have a different spectral reflectance, also the acryl color, for instance, but we still have the same light source, but we still have a match. But if we change, in addition to the acryl color, also a different light source, then there is a mismatch. I think I showed you an example of two green colors in here, mismatch, but if I go outside daylight, they appear exactly the same. Okay, we talked about distress. We don't have to do that. Okay, yes. And that's the beauty. Without metamerism, it would not be possible to use such devices, or a projector, or a CMYK printer. We would not be able to produce a green color by mixing cyan and yellow, or a yellow color by using red and green from the projector. Do you get the point? That's the beauty of metamerism. Okay. I said 5 minutes, and still... that would have been the next chapter. I will squeeze that in somewhere, okay? Because color difference is also important for cross media. Also, I'm fully aware of, also to talk about color science within 4 hours is very, very difficult. You know, it's really huge. So. Please have a look at the slides, and I also uploaded another publication on color differences used for 3D printing, where they used extensions in the formulas to satisfy the 3D appearance compared to only having a 2D. Okay? And yes. Sorry for the delay. We meet tomorrow again, 10:15. And if I remember correctly, subject research methodology. I think so. Okay, thanks.
litt forvirrende å begynne å lete fram her, da. For vi har så kort tid, men det skal nå gå.